The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Magazine Hour on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today I'll be reading from the April 23rd, 2018 edition of the New Yorker Magazine. I'll begin today with a poem by Jennifer Chang entitled, "We Found the Body of a Young Deer Once." White tails flicker like light in the winter woods, where my dog and I crack open the early morning, the ground a frozen patchwork of leaves, the brittle ice of dirt. So much of walking is description. Late in the year, the sun stops us cold. Or walking is comparison. These woods in New Jersey seem, a passing thought, Ohioan. Then I recall that late thaw one March in New Hampshire. Or I'm 10 again, wondering where I last saw the deer carcass. Maybe by the creek? Maybe loose ribs? A skull tucked into snow? As children, we set out old logs against a middling elm, thatched branches into a sort of rooftop called our dwelling, antelope. My friend and I, we ignored the sky cutting into our shelter and made walls of found particle board, fragmentary, damp, worthless as kindling. Her mother worshipped Zoroaster. Her father had an Irish-American mistress. Stub of birch, first rime graying the last moss. The ground fascinates a spray of blue jays. Her father, as a university student, had dined with the Shaw. Whenever her mother polished the silver, we'd joke, "The Shaw is coming to tea." From upstairs, we could smell duck stewing in walnuts and pomegranate syrup. Later, the darkest meat fell to pieces onto bright particulate rice. It was like eating a secret, my mouth stunned by acid sweetness. A terrible hunger I could not explain to my own mother. I wanted more. Another plate, please. Instead, into the winter woods we ran after this new world that knew nothing of what we hid on our tongues. Other words for dusk, revolution, and snow. We dismissed our appetites. We forgot our fathers. Farther, farther I am going into the dark of the mind. That neighbor girl, my friend, she goes by Mrs. Bell now, so I hear, lives out west, plants tulips every November, and come spring, sighs each one mid-stem. A crystal vase in the breakfast nook, Cheerios in her son's bowls, her dumb, accomplished husband nodding at the clock. It was with her I found the body of a young deer, fallen in a clearing. Fresh snow powdering the deer's coat like fresh ash fallen from a proximate fire. Quiet. Quieter than I'd ever been with anyone. We shared the death. We stood quietly, the sky open and gray above us. We never said a word about the deer. I imagine that winter as helming decay, the woods beastly, skeletal, far reach of the trees, the deer's bone cage stripped clean of flesh. She showed me a map of Iran in my father's world atlas. In Tehran they had had many servants, including a gardener and a night nurse for her and her brother, though she was too young to remember any of this. The day after solstice, I note an emerald shine to the pale sky. On the question of origin, she explained, Persian. Once I described my mother as always angry. She was born amid a civil war. But mostly my childhood was a quiet one. It was not until years later that I learned others had considered our family strange. And now, from the Our Local Correspondence section, an essay entitled The Maraschino Mogul. After the bees turned red, Arthur Mondella's cherry empire revealed its secrets, by Ian Fraser. Arthur Mondella is mourned. Up until the moment of his death on February 24, 2015, he ran his family's companies, Dell's Maraschino Cherries, in the Red Hook section of Brooklyn. His daughters, Dana Mondello Bentz and Dominique Mondella, who run the company now, miss him every day. They remember him in their prayers and wish he could see how they've done with the business. Their great-grandfather, Arthur Mondella Sr., and their grandfather, Ralph, founded it in 1948. Dell's Maraschino Cherries processes and sells nothing but cherries, about 14 million pounds a year, from its single Red Hook factory. Dana, the president and CEO, is 30, and Dominique, the vice president, is 32. One might not expect that Mondella's death also would have saddened many of New York City's beekeepers, but it did. People in the beekeeping community, or their bees, had crossed paths with Mondella in 2010, less than 5 years before he died. In fact, the complications in Mondella's life that led to his demise had a minor but significant bee component. The first small signs that all was not right with him arrived buzzing in the air. Though circumstances put Mondella and the bees on opposite sides of an issue, the beekeepers still speak admiringly of him and express regret at his unhappy end. The summer of 2010 was the hottest ever recorded in the city. By July, heat reflected from the pavement had scorched the leaves of street trees, creating a false, uncolorful fall. In gardens, blossoms dried and withered, and the weeds by highway entrances took on the appearance of twisted wire. As summer progressed, to add further touch of the apocalyptic bees returning at the end of the day to hives in Red Hook began to glow and indicate incandescent red. Some local beekeepers found the sight of red bees flying in the sunset strangely beautiful. All of them had noticed that their honey was turning red, too. What next? They wondered. Bees go through a lot. Colony collapse, disorder, the decimation of entire hives has been a worrisome problem worldwide. Pesticides, parasites, lack of flowers and other forage, erratic weather, and disease have caused drastic declines in bee populations. Hornets sometimes get into a hive and eat bees, honey, honeycombs, and all. Because the red bees were city bees, nobody took the sudden change in the color of their honey as a promising development. Until March of that year, it had not been legal to keep bees in the city. A few beekeepers had evaded the ban by camouflaging their hives with faux brick contact paper or otherwise making them blend in with the rooftops. The outlaws got a kick out of defying former Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, who had initiated the ban. Immediately after the Board of Health voted to lift it, the number of beekeepers multiplied. According to David Selig, a restaurateur who began keeping bees on the roof of his Red Hook apartment building in 2006, the number of the hives in the area went from about three to more than a dozen. In the summer's unprecedented heat, water and nectar became harder to find. At Added Value Farms, a public garden and composting site in Red Hook, Tim O'Neill, who teaches biology in middle school and at Brooklyn College, looked into the problem. O'Neill also keeps bees and writes a blog, Burrow Bees. In it, he speculated that the red honey might be connected to the nearby service depots for the MTA buses and to a substance called ethylene glycol. Bees, pets, and children have been known to sample motor fluids that contain ethylene glycol because it tastes sweet. The results are sometimes fatal. He thought the bees might be bringing back the spilled transmission fluid or antifreeze from the depots, and he advised his fellow beekeepers not to taste any red honey until it had been tested. Cerise Mayo, a food and farm consultant who kept bees both in the garden and on Governor's Island, just off the Red Hook shore, wondered why her island bees, separated from land by 600 yards of water, were also producing red honey. No one is sure who first began to think of the cherry factory. Bees were observed flying in its direction and visiting puddles of red juice around it on the sidewalk. In early September, O'Neill took chunks of honeycomb from hives in and near the garden, put them in 50-milliliter sample tubes, and mailed them to the state apiculturalist in Albany for testing. About a month later, he received the results. The honey tested positive for FD&C red number 40, a food-safe dye, which is an ingredient of the maraschino syrup used by Dill's factory. In November, the Times broke the story, which ran on the front page under the headline, "In Mystery and Culture Clash, Some Brooklyn Bees Turn Red." Cerise Mayo was quoted, voicing her distress that her bees were getting their honey from the syrup. Because her name sounded possibly made up, and her first name means cherry in French, a Times researcher had called her to make sure she was real. The story considered the problem in the context of the gentrification of Red Hook, with the factory standing for the old neighborhood and the beekeepers for the new. The idea of the red bee somehow clicked with readers, and scores of news outlets picked up the story. David Selig, whom it also mentioned, turned on his computer the morning the story came out and found 3,000 emails from people I'd never heard of and from people I never knew. The Times story contained no quotes from Arthur Mondella, who had not returned phone calls asking for comment. It noted that Mondella had been in touch with Andrew Cote, the founder of the New York City Beekeepers Association, to try to find a solution. Cote is the most famous beekeeper in New York. He keeps bees at several city sites, including on the grounds of the UN, and sells New York City honey at the Union Square Green Market. He is a handsome, hazel-eyed man of French-Canadian parentage with a suave black beard going gray. Cote's life has included many adventures, such as hanging upside down 19 stories above Times Square to remove a swarm of bees from a window washer stanchion with a special low-suction bee vacuuming device he built for himself, and securing hives on a roof at the request of Secret Service agents who planned to position snipers there and did not want any bees getting into a sniper's ear. "The red honey tasted terrible, by the way," Cote told me one afternoon at his market stall. "It was sickly sweet, kind of metallic tasting and watery. But after the story went all over the place online, I could have sold a ton of it. I had dozens of customers asking for it. And all that red honey ended up being thrown out. Those beekeepers lost a season of production." He showed me a few vials of the red honey he kept as souvenirs. "I really liked Arthur Mondella," Cote went on. "Arthur was genuine, a true Brooklyn guy, and he had that accent. Out of the blue, before the newspaper story, he got in touch about the bee situation and asked me to come to the factory. I didn't go until right after the story appeared. I knew there would be a lot of reporters around, so I asked if he could be there really early, like 5 a.m. He said, 'I'll make it my business to be there.' I'll always remember that. I showed him how to put some screens up, make the lids of his bins tighter, control the spills. It was not a difficult adjustment at all, and we solved the problem. Afterward, I sent him an invoice for my services. He paid it, and that was that. Throughout the whole thing, he was a gentleman." No other beekeepers dealt as extensively with Mondella. All were grateful for his level-headed response. "We had been legal for less than a year," Selig said. "He could have made a fuss about why he had to deal with all these local bees, and we appreciated that his first reaction wasn't to call the exterminator." Meanwhile, also taking an interest in the story, the authorities saw an opportunity. According to later news reports, there had been rumors starting in 2009 that Mondella was growing marijuana. Law enforcement hoped that the attention being directed at the cherry factory might reveal more about what went on inside it. Quiet inquiries were made about the factory's floor plan. Arthur Ralph Mandela was named after his grandfather, Arthur, and his father, Ralph. The family came from Naples, though Ralph was born in America. In Italy, Arthur Sr. had been a baker, and he wanted to get out of that business because he did not like working 7 days a week. He and Ralph began making maraschino cherries in a small factory on Henry Street in Carroll Gardens. The cherries, which traditionally embellished ice cream sundaes and cocktails, were not steeped in maraschino, the Italian wild cherry liqueur. Since Prohibition, most maraschino cherries have not contained maraschino. Instead, the Mandelas use a secret recipe involving sugar, citric acid, red coloring, and a curing process that never subjected the fruit to hot water. The cold water-only approach preserves the cherry's crunch, the family says. All of the production was small batch and hand-done. The hours turned out to be just as long as those in a bakery. Arthur, of the second American generation of the family, was born in 1957. He grew up in Bay Ridge, attended Xavier in high school, and got a full scholarship to New York University. After graduating with a degree in finance, he went to Wall Street, where he found a job with an investment firm. He did not want to work in the cherry factory at all. But in 1983, his father had a heart attack, and Arthur set aside his financial career to take over the company. Arthur Sr. was long dead by then. When Arthur, the grandson, examined with an ex-Wall Streeter's eye the company he had inherited, he saw room for improvement. In the 1970s, it had moved from Carroll Gardens to Dyckman Street in Red Hook. Mandela set about expanding that location into two adjacent buildings, and eventually the factory occupied a total floor space of 38,000 square feet. He scaled up what had been essentially a mom-and-pop operation. His mother and his sister, Joanne, worked there, but he ran the show, increasing production capacity and acquiring large-volume food service clients. In 2014, he made a $7 million investment in automation so that one day the place would run itself, as he told his daughters. Despite automating, he wanted to keep his human workforce intact. By all accounts, he cared about his employees. Lots of ex-offenders had jobs at Dell's. The Red Hook houses, a nearby low-income housing project, supplied him with workers who needed the paycheck. Mandela was known for giving salary advances and loans whose repayment was not vigorously pursued. He hired a homeless man, providing him an advance for a deposit, and let him use a company truck to move into a new apartment. Gang tattoos could be seen on the muscular maraschino red-stained arms of guys on the factory floor. The most commonly used news photo of Mandela shows him leaning into a cherry processing machine, small and serious-looking, behind the mass of bright red cherries in the foreground. He's wearing a white lab coat, and a plastic shower cap covers his hair. A terrible picture of him, his daughters say. He was a slim man, not tall, with dark eyes and a seamed, careworn face. He used colorful language, according to several accounts. In his office, he had a video monitor that showed the factory floor, and when he saw something going wrong, he would appear suddenly and yell at those responsible. Unless he was meeting a customer, he dressed in jeans and a t-shirt. But he always wore white sneakers and asked for new pairs every year from his family for Christmas. He always ended up getting red stains on his white shoes, and he went through a lot of them. He lived on Staten Island in a distant neighborhood called Graniteville until he and the girls' mothers divorced. Dominique and Dana and their mother stayed in Graniteville, and Mandela moved back to Brooklyn, where he eventually married a Ukrainian woman. They had a daughter, Antoinette, who is more than 20 years younger than her half-sisters. Later, Mandela divorced again and moved in with his new girlfriend. But during all this time, he spent most of his life at the factory. Dominique and Dana both went to Moore Catholic High School on Staten Island and then to St. John's University, where Dana got a degree in accounting and Dominique got a degree in finance. Mandela said that after college, one of them had to work for him. Dominique had worked off and on at the factory since high school, doing many jobs from billing customers to booking flights for her father's business trips. After she graduated, she went back to the company full-time. Dana was hired at PricewaterhouseCoopers, the international accounting firm, and began a job at its Midtown office right out of college, often putting in 16-hour days. She met a man in banking, Tom Bentz, and they married in 2013. He also works for the family company. Dana and Dominique share an office next to the one that used to be their father's. Last year, I visited them there. Dominique is pretty and dark. Dana is pretty and blonde, and both intensify their eyes with mascara. "My father was just a very, very smart man," Dominique told me. "He wasn't an engineer. He wasn't a mechanic. But the guys on the floor said he could fix any machine himself. Like, I could ask him, 'Dad, how do I fix my phone? How do I back it up?' And he knew. He would always introduce me to the latest technology." Dana said, "He didn't have hobbies. He wasn't into sports. He was into movies, a movie buff. When we were little kids, my parents were divorced, so he would pick us up and we would go to Blockbuster and we would pick out a bunch of movies and just watch movies. He used to cook these huge barbecues for us, and I'd be like, 'Dad, there's only four of us. We could have a meal like this for like 25 people. Well, he was really specific in what he liked, Dominique said. If he had a salad, it had to be only oil and vinegar on it. Or if he wanted to have this brand of rice, it had to be this specific brand of rice. Potato chips always had to be crinkle cut." Dana described going on errands to buy her father bread. "So I drive from Staten Island to Brooklyn to 13th Avenue, where my dad wanted me to get the bread. So I call him. I'm like, 'Dad, I can't find the bakery.' And he's like, 'What? You don't know where it is on 13th Avenue? Click. So I found a bakery on 14th Avenue. So I get to his apartment. He breaks the bread open and he's like, 'This isn't from 13th Avenue. This is from 14th Avenue. And I'm like, "How does this guy even know?" The smell of maraschino cherries, not unpleasant, but eye-wateringly strong, fills the factory, and the floors remain sticky even though they're constantly mopped. Sometimes, neighbors in apartments overlooking the building caught a few whiffs of marijuana along with the cherries. David Selig thought the smell of pot might be the result of workmen smoking it on their breaks. Later news stories said that a postal employee had told authorities that marijuana was being grown on the premises, but the police had failed to find suspicious signs. An increase in energy consumption consistent with the use of grow lights had not been detected, possibly because the factory had its own gasoline-powered generators, and a drug-sniffing dog had not been able to discover a definitive scent of marijuana. Independently, environmental investigators, acting on a tip, began to look into possible violations in the dumping of wastewater from the cherry manufacturing processes into the sewer. Meanwhile, the Brooklyn DA's office more or less forgot about the marijuana investigation. Inquiry into what might be going on at the cherry factory did not proceed much beyond rumor and speculation. The heightened attention caused by the bee episode had increased the factory's visibility. In 2013, Brooklyn elected a new DA, Kenneth Thompson, who set out to clean up pollution in the borough. His office decided to take a look at some installed environmental cases. "My father was a funny man in that he didn't share much," Dominique said. "That was just the way he was. We've come to find out only after his death what a pioneer he was in this business." Dana said, "Well, he was very private. We'd ask him questions when we were little, and his response would be, 'What are you, writing a book?' Now, don't get us wrong. He wanted us to learn. But at the factory, he would have wanted to make the decisions for us," Dominique said. "The capacity that we're working at now, he would be so impressed," Dana said. "But I don't know if he would have been able to see that, not in his lifetime, because it wasn't in his nature to see it, to allow us to run with an idea, especially as it pertains to here. He was the type of person that did everything on his own." "Well, it's not that he didn't have confidence in who we were," Dominique said. "He knew that he raised two smart girls." A lot of Dominique's and my growth didn't occur until after his passing. Like, if my father were here, I would not be here. I would still be at PricewaterhouseCoopers doing audits. Well, I think you would be here. Maybe down the road, but not this early. Our father could be really hard on you, but when he was nice, you would forget about that. He gave us everything financially that we could have asked for, but we were not spoiled. Dana, see if you had the picture of you and him and Antoinette at the wedding. Well, my dad gave me the most impressive, gorgeous wedding I could have ever asked for. It was 145 people at our Lady Queen of Peace in Staten Island, and we had the reception at the Palace in Somerset Park, New Jersey. I wore a white silk dress. De Pascal at Nelson and Amboy on Staten Island did my hair. I watch the video of the wedding sometimes, and it's nice. My dad is in it. We were just very proud of him. Proud of our parent. When the raid finally happened, it was a surprise. On February 24, 2015, a Tuesday, during working hours, officers from the Department of Environmental Protection, the New York City Police Department, and the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office came to the Cherry Factory with a warrant to search parts of the premises for evidence of illegal dumping of wastewater. A lawyer for the company later described the action as a guns-blazing raid, which it was not, but the officers did arrive in numbers. Their warrant hadn't allowed for the searching of Arthur Mandela himself. As the officers moved through his factory, he became more and more agitated. While examining some shelves, they found what appeared to be a false wall, and they told him that they were going to send for a warrant to search behind it. As they waited for the warrant, Mandela excused himself to use the bathroom. Once inside, he locked the door and would not come out. The police tried to persuade him to unlock the door. He refused and asked them to bring his sister, Joanne. They did. Through the door, he said to her, "Take care of the kids." Then he shot himself in the head with a .357 Magnum pistol he had been carrying in an ankle holster. To have strangers going through his factory must have seemed, for such an inward and self-created man, as if the invaders were rummaging around in his brain. The factory was his world. He had thought of everything in it. He was it. When he suddenly could not control what was occurring in it or what was about to occur, he could erase the nightmare only by erasing himself. Experience has shown that the revealing of a secret life can be a motivation for suicide. But nobody saw the catastrophe coming or imagined the loneliness of this man. The day it happened, Dominique called me, and I was like, "What? What do you mean? Was he depressed?" And Dana said, "I mean, I don't understand." And then all the news about the marijuana came out. We never knew. Reading the articles that came out, that was how we knew, Dominique said. I guess he was protecting us. Well, I remember I was actually out sick that day, Dana said. And then I came here, and I saw that there was a lot of police activity, and I didn't understand because if somebody killed themselves, why would there be this many police? Behind the false wall, the officers discovered a ladder leading down to a large basement, 2,500 square feet, and space for about 100 marijuana plants and a well-set-up system of hydroponic cultivation under LED grow lights. They also found about 100 pounds of harvested marijuana, $130,000 in cash, and a small office containing a desk with books on plant husbandry and a copy of the World Encyclopedia of Organized Crime. In a garage area, they came upon a collection of vintage cars, a Bentley and a Rolls Royce, among them, which suggested that Mandela led a flashier life when not at the factory. Later reports mentioned his use of cocaine, his boat, his lavish spending in restaurants, and his fiance, a former penthouse model. Had Mandela lived, he could have gone to jail for 2 or 3 years. More likely, he would have received probation. The DA charged the company with criminal possession of marijuana in the first degree, a felony, and with failing to comply with laws relating to wastewater dumping, a misdemeanor. The company pleaded guilty to both charges and paid a fine of $1.2 million. After that judgment, no further charges were filed. The DA did not want to destroy a successful local business that provided a number of Brooklyn residents with jobs. Also, investigators had been unable to find evidence to prove that the marijuana was being sold, nor had they tried very hard to find such evidence. The volume of the operation, obviously larger than was needed for personal use, implied that Mandela had been selling it. How? And to whom? And who helped him build the farm? Who serviced the plumbing, the wiring, the grower lights? Remained intriguing questions he was not around to answer. In his will, Mandela left an estate that included $8.5 million in cash, more than enough to cover the fine. Dana and Dominique received 55% of the company between them. Joanne, their aunt, got 20%, and 25% went to Antoinette, their half-sister. The older daughters decided to take personal charge of the business they now controlled. After the news of the raid, some customers dropped Dell's for other cherry suppliers. But by traveling the country to meet with customers individually, Dana and Dominique were able to keep most of them and later persuaded a few who'd left to come back. Most of their large volume restaurant chains stayed on. A young employee, Joshua Sabino, had been hired by Mandela the day before the raid. Sabino was excited about his new job, but when he saw the police everywhere, he figured that the factory would have to close. He had been grateful to Mandela for hiring him. "But the factory closed for only 2 days," he told me. "They kept all the workers, and we even got paid for the days it was closed. I felt like Mr. Mandela was still taking care of me." In May of 2016, Dana and Dominique sued the city for recklessness and negligence in the death of their father, saying that the raid to search for environmental violations had been only a ruse, that officers had obtained a warrant fraudulently, and that the police should have taken their father's gun from him to protect him from harming himself. Their lawyer, Richard Luthman of Staten Island, characterized the raid as a cowboys and Indians operation that got out of hand, and he asked for $50 million in damages and penalties. The following April, Judge Leo Glasser, a federal judge in the Eastern District, issued a ruling in which he called the claims preposterous and threw the lawsuit out. The officers had no duty to protect Mandela from suicide, Glasser said. The warrant did not call for searching him. He was never in police custody, and no one could have reasonably expected that he might shoot himself over a misdemeanor environmental violation. When I called Luthman to ask about Glasser's verdict, he sounded undaunted and said he planned to appeal. Glasser is a famous judge, 94 years old, a Bronze Star veteran of the Second World War. "Now, he's a wonderful judge, don't misunderstand me," Luthman said, "but he's the same guy who put John Gotti away, and I think he may be a little hard on Italians, and he may suspect that they're all criminals and in the mafia. Frankly, I believe this is a decision that could be dangerous to police officers, because here's this potential suspect who was allowed to walk around with a weapon while the investigation of his premises was going on." He added, "If the DA's office had done their homework, they could have found out that this man was licensed to carry a firearm." As for Mandela's possible criminal ties, his ex-brother-in-law, Salvador Capisi, the former husband of Joanne, served 5 years in jail for money laundering, and Salvatore's brother, Vincent, had a rap sheet for drug offenses that went back to the 1980s. In 1994, Vincent participated in a smuggling ring that brought $17 million worth of marijuana from California to New York in sealed metal containers, a crime for which he was given a 33-month sentence. Mandela and Salvatore Capisi had been known to spend time together. Glasser's decision made no reference to these circumstances. Despite Mandela's last words to his sister, she was not involved with her nieces assuming control of the company or with their later decisions about it, and evidently this did not sit well with her. In March 2017, Joanne sued Dana and Dominique for mismanaging the company, pushing her out, slashing her salary, and ceasing to pay for her leased Mercedes-Benz. Joanne asked that her previous position, salary, and perks be restored to her, or that the company be sold so that she could receive her 20%. Her mother, Dana and Dominique's grandmother, Antoinette, also sued. asking for restoration of the company car that she had been provided with for more than 50 years, which they had taken away. Commenting on these lawsuits, Luthman told the news that under Dana and Dominique, the company was doing better than ever, and that this family squabbling was a shame. He added, it was Joanne and Antoinette that fired the first shot. Though I never met Luthman in person, I found him helpful on the phone. A follow-up story of December 16, 2017 made me wonder if I had been talking to the same guy. It's said that Richard Luthman, identified as a Staten Island attorney, yes, it was the same guy, and two other men had been arrested for wire fraud, kidnapping, extortion, brandishing a weapon, identity theft, and money laundering. There were 11 charges in all. The alleged scheme involved a scrap metal dealer co-conspirator, the sale to foreign customers of shipments of scrap metal that turned out to contain mostly concrete blocks. A blind client of Luthman's, whose identity the conspirators used in order to set up bank accounts and launder almost $500,000 obtained by this fraud, and the later kidnapping of the scrap metal dealer for the purpose of extorting an extra $10,000 from him at gunpoint. Luthman is a big man who appears in many photos wearing a red bow tie, a tight-fitting powder blue suit, and round glasses. He once challenged a rival in a lawsuit to settle the issue through trial by combat. Luthman spent 12 weeks in jail before his release on bail a few weeks ago. He has denied all the charges and is awaiting a May trial. During his incarceration, the deadline lapsed for filing an appeal of Dana and Dominique's suit against the city. Luthman is currently banned from practicing law, so another lawyer will take over the intrafamily lawsuits, which are still pending. Every summer, Mandela used to host a barbecue for his employees, providing all the food and doing the cooking for everyone. There was no barbecue the summer after he died. But in 2016, the tradition resumed, close to his birthday, on June 25th, and in 2017, the company continued it. On the day in July when the event took place, I wandered around Red Hook in the morning, checking out the beehives at Added Value Farms, then sheltering under a tent there during a rain downpour. The rain slackened to a drizzle. Dana was sending me emails saying the barbecue was being delayed until the rain stopped. Red Hook is a waterfront place, with the Statue of Liberty, a near neighbor across the harbor, and a high oceanic sky that's larger because none of the buildings are tall. I strolled past businesses that are part of the neighborhood's current incarnation: Fleischer's Craft Butchery, Widow Jane Distillery, Steve's Authentic Key Lime Pie, Flickinger Glass Works. The hot, humid air smelled of the open water it was blowing in from. Finally, the rain quit and patches of blue sky opened up. On Dyckman Street's wide sidewalk next to a delivery gate for the cherry factory, workmen were sitting on folding chairs beside a table laid with sodas and picnic paraphernalia. Tom Bentz, Dana's husband, was cooking burgers, hot dogs, and marinated chicken breasts on a gas grill the size of a small bus. It had different grilling venues and ventilator hoods and shelves and control knobs of varying sizes. Someone's CD player was blasting rap music with lyrics that did not mess around. Tom, Dana, and Dominique wore black T-shirts printed with the Dell's logo in white. Most of the workmen wore sleeveless shirts, and all were red splattered, and generally a sunburned shade of maraschino red. Leon Perry, who began his job at the factory after his release from prison 20 years ago, told me how Mandela had loaned him money for rent when he started out. Minno Johnson, a mechanic, said Mandela had funded his studies at trade school. Arthur Casey remembered when Mandela paid for his $300 cab ride home one night when he had to work late. Afterward, during the cleanup, Leon Perry pointed to the grill, which Tom was scraping with a metal spatula, and said, "This was his grill." For a moment, it was as if Mandela himself had materialized there on Dyckman Street, analogized by this amazing piece of equipment. Tom looked at the sky. "It cleared up," he said. That was Dana and Dominique's father looking down. The guys posed for a group photo, smiling with red arms around one another's shoulders, and then went back to work. I asked Dominique and Dana why they had decided to take over running the company themselves. After all, they could have assembled a committee of consultants, asked for input, done a search for a plant manager, let someone else direct the business day to day, or they could have sold it. Recent years have seen the buyout of other maraschino cherry companies by large corporations like Green Giant Foods. "Well, this is all our father left," Dana explained. "He didn't have a home. His cars were taken away by the investigation. I didn't get to sort through his things. He lived with his girlfriend, and it's not really my place to go into her apartment and start grabbing things. What I would have loved would have been like even if I'd had a pair of cufflinks, so I had something that's tangible of his. The only tangible thing that we have left of him is this place. This was his life. It was his blood, sweat, and tears," Dominique said. "When my father came, the business was failing, and he took a risk. He put everything he had into it, and he made it so much better, a real success. When we came, it looked as if it was going to fail because of everything that was happening around it, and we took a risk. We put every inch of ourselves into it. I lost my father, and I had to come back 2 days later and go to work. You didn't have time to mourn. He wouldn't have even wanted that. He wouldn't have wanted us to dwell. He would have been like, 'Get up! Let's go! What are you doing?' It's definitely been very stressful, but I always think positive," Dominique said. "And I'm more realistic," Dana said. "I try not to think about the factory 24/7, but I'm dreaming about it at night, seeing the cherries, the different sizes in my head. We sell 5 different sizes, from small to medium to large to extra large to colossal, with stems and without. So that's 10 different kinds. Also, crushed cherries and cherries in halves," Dominique said. "And in different colors, not only red. It's a statistic that a lot of family businesses don't survive past the second generation," Dana said. "My dad was in the 3rd generation, and now we're the 4th. You can make it work. It's just a lot of hard work and dedication. Growing up, he always taught us, like, be responsible," Dominique said. "We just knew we had to step up." And now from the On Television, a review entitled "Whitish: The Meaning of One Joke on Roseanne" by Emily Nussbaum. In the 3rd episode of Roseanne on ABC, Roseanne Connor and her husband Dan wake up on their iconic sofa in Lanford, Illinois. "It's 11 o'clock," Roseanne says. "We sleep from Wheel to Kimmel." And Dan replies, "Oh, we miss all the shows about black and Asian families." And Roseanne squawks, "They're just like us." And then sardonically, "There, now you're all caught up." It would be so nice to be able to hunker down on my own sofa with Roseanne, the blockbuster sitcom from my 20s, a feminist show that was tough about class, with pioneering gay characters and a memorably complex teen girl. It would feel good to critique the new version with a tolerant smile, to say simply that you shouldn't judge any sitcom too harshly early on. In a review of this type, you'd emphasize the gulf between the actress Roseanne Barr, a rich pro-Trump Twitter troll, and the character Roseanne Connor, a poor, disabled, rural grandma who voted for Trump because he talked jobs. You'd point out that neither Roseanne is Roseanne. You might praise Ames McNamara, who plays Roseanne's genderqueer grandson, Mark, or admire John Goodman, a prickly force after 20 years. And you could, say, lie back and think of Norman Lear. I can't write that review, though, and it's because of zingers like the one above, dog whistles that won't let you stay inside Roseanne. Trump comes up only in the pilot, in which Roseanne scraps with her Jill Stein voting sister Jackie, Laura Metcalf, who wears a nasty woman t-shirt and yammers like a cartoon lib. But after Trump fades away, his grin lingers. Take Roseanne's joke. The jab was clearly aimed at Blackish and Fresh Off the Boat, comedies that share ABC's Tuesday schedule with Roseanne. The line establishes a few things. One is that Connors don't live in the same America as the Johnsons from Blackish or the Huangs from Fresh Off the Boat. There will never be a crossover episode. No fun clash, say, between an aging Jessica Huang and Roseanne on a Connor trip to Florida. Instead, the Connors are themselves bored, alienated ABC viewers, unable even to remember titles, just that those are the Black and Asian shows. If you read the Hollywood trades, you might sense an unsettling frame to that joke, too. ABC is owned by Disney, which is seeking to buy Fox, a merger that could be scuttled by Trump, who has a habit of threatening media corporations that cross him. And Trump has opinions about Blackish. When the series debuted in 2014, he tweeted, "How is ABC television allowed to have a show entitled Blackish? Can you imagine the furor of a show Whitish? Racism at the highest level?" End quote. The month before Roseanne premiered, ABC pulled an episode of Blackish in it. In it, Dre Johnson tells his baby son a bedtime story about race in America. Believe me, no punchline appears on ABC without getting okayed all the way to the top. Of course, Roseanne Connor didn't make that crude joke that Trump made. So far, at least the show doesn't traffic in any heavy clash of perspectives, as in Lear's shows from the 70s, in which Maude Finley and George Jefferson held their own against Archie Bunker. No one on Roseanne has used the word racist, let alone lobbed a slur. Instead, the show relies on code, such as when Roseanne snarked that Jackie might want to take a knee, even as her Black granddaughter, Mary, played by Jaden Ray, sits nearby, an irony no one remarks on. The missing jokes are the show's tell. When Jackie fights Roseanne, she takes no real shots at Trump, narrowing the debate to Jobs and Hillary, as if the two of them were guests on Hannity. The show's repeated theme is always that Roseanne is not that kind of Trump voters. She's sweet to Mary. She defends Mark against homophobic bullies. You might see this as a complexity or as a spin. If you're in a darker mood, you might call it propaganda. So instead of a straight shot, Roseanne and Dan take a sideways jab at their ABC slot mates. They're old news. They're everywhere. An irritant, a snooze. But Dan couldn't be referring to any other network sitcoms about Black and Asian families because none exist. That's true even on ABC, which just a few years ago was branding itself the Diversity Network, sparked by the success of Shonda Rhimes, and maybe by the presence of President Obama. Blackish is the first Black network family sitcom since 2006, when the Bernie Mac show ended its run on Fox. Fresh Off the Boat is the first Asian family show in history, not counting All American Girl in 1994, which ended after one season. They're fragile phenomena. After the success of Lear and then of Bill Cosby, there were brief, exciting vogues for ethnic comedy. But year by year, those shows got gentrified off the comedy block from NBC to Fox to WB, UPN, BET. That's how change often works in mass culture, in waves that recede. The other thing that Roseanne doesn't mention is that there are two other ABC sitcoms about families just like them. The Middle, which also airs on Tuesday, and Speechless. Both shows, like Roseanne, portray white lower middle class couples weighed down by credit card debt and living with disabled family members in messy homes they can't afford to fix. The Middle is currently lipping toward its final series finale, but it spent 8 seasons delivering a smart, salty portrait of blue-collar life in Indiana. Roseanne and Dan aren't watching The Middle, however. They don't make a meta joke about how it was created by two writers who worked on the original Roseanne. The Middle can't exist if Roseanne wants to strike that primal chord of white resentment, that more or any black or brown faces mean less room for white people. This usual amnesia is also what enabled ABC to use the slogan, "A family that looks like us," when selling Roseanne to advertisers. A dog whistle so strong that it might have brought Lassie back from the dead. Roseanne's crack that "they're just like us" has a historical context, too. It's an allusion to the bland family sitcoms of the 1980s, when syrupy, anti-racist, very special episodes dominated primetime comedy. Think Family Ties, treating colorblindness as a virtue. In 1988, Roseanne helped puncture that formula, and with it the liberal fantasy that bigotry was just a misunderstanding that might be fixed by credits. Roseanne's joke makes no sense, though. The ABC Tuesday night black and Asian family sitcoms aren't "they're just like us" stories. To the contrary, they're downright gonzo in their cultural specificity, spiked with in-jokes. Ironically, these are the shows that most directly carry on the legacy of the original, deeply autobiographical Roseanne, which was a truth serum in a media devoted to reassuring lies. Kenya Barris's Blackish is just as personal and often as unsettling. It's a raucous series about a class-hopping African-American dad, uncomfortable in his bourgeois family, and a story drawn from its creator's life. Fresh Off the Boat, whose showrunner is the Persian-American Nanatcha Khan, is a dizzy retro experiment adapted from Eddie Huang's memoir about a hip-hop-obsessed child of Taiwanese immigrant strivers. But both shows mine their best comedy from difference, not sameness. Asian immigrants who take pride in the gulf between them and their neighbors, a black man so anxious about a white neighbor knowing he can't swim that he nearly drowns. On both shows, family love, however, the relatable, doesn't exist in a political vacuum. As Dre Johnson and Jessica Wong continually warn their children, you can't understand who you are unless you know your history. That probably goes for sitcoms, too. After the new Roseanne debuted to impressive numbers, Trump, notorious for lying about the ratings of The Apprentice, called Barr to congratulate her. But in Roseanne's case, the ratings were real, which made sense. Aside from nostalgia, there's a powerful appeal to any project that reassures Vox viewers without alienating the MSNBC crowd. This show offers a clever finger trap for critics. Call it a dangerous hit, and you imply that it's really quite sexy. And in fact, the seventh episode, which I won't spoil, pulls a daring switcheroo, one that may offer a new lens through which to interpret Roseanne's behavior. It's not enough. The reboot nods at complexity without delivering. There are good people on many sides. If you squint, you might see the show's true hero as Darlene, played by Sarah Gilbert, a broke, single mom forced to move in with that charismatic bully, Roseanne. But if that were so, we might understand Darlene's politics, too. We'd more fully feel her pain, and also that of her two kids transplanted to a place they find foreign and unwelcoming. Instead, Roseanne's cackling drowns these stories out, and that's what star power is. In the third episode, Darlene's daughter, Harris, played by Emma Kinney, hogs the dryer. She has her reasons, we learn. She is so desperate to go back to Chicago that she's dealing shoplifted clothing. But we're encouraged to see her through her grandmother's eyes as a spoiled urban brat. When Roseanne calls Harris an entitled little bitch, Harris calls her a stupid old hillbilly. Then Roseanne tricks her granddaughter into cleaning a plate, and when she does, Roseanne shoves Harris's head into the sink hard and then sprays her, saying, "Welcome to the Hillbilly Day Spa!" The crowd goes wild. It's boomers versus Gen Y. Catharsis with a pro wrestling jolt. In between conspiracy theories, Roseanne tweeted, "Watch how I handle her and her very liberal mother." But would a Chicago teenager call her MAGA grandma a hillbilly? Must slang from another era? No way. She'd call her a bigot, an asshole, or maybe, if things got heated, a slur with its own nasty history, white trash. That might make it an uglier confrontation for sure, but a fair fight is one that reveals the truth. And now we have time for one or two cartoons. The first one has a picture of a car that has smashed into a fire hydrant. The young woman is on the phone on the driver's side, and a man with a beard is standing on the other side of the car. And she says into the phone, "And just like that, Facebook is giving us ads for used cars, optometrists, and couples counseling." In the next cartoon, we see a picture of Jesus sitting on a rock with his disciples gathered around on the ground. And one of the disciples has his hand raised very high, waving his hand back and forth. And Jesus says to him, "I see you, Jake, but does anyone have a question that's not about carpentry?" And in the final cartoon, we see a operating room, the man on the operating table, and doctors gathered around him with newspapers, cell phones, and a laptop that they were pointing at him. And the one surgeon is saying, "First, we numb you by showing you today's headlines." Well, sounds like we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening as much as I did reading. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts at our website at triangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.